Welcome to the Week in 60 Minutes, brought to you by Spectator TV and recorded on Thursday, January the 28th. This week's cover story, the vaccine wars turn nasty in Europe. We'll take a look at the EU's temper tantrum over its sluggish supply and ask if this is a sign of things to come. Schools and border controls have dominated domestic news this week. The Spectator's political team will report on the latest developments. We'll head down under to discover how Australia's travel quarantine system has worked. And on the 300th anniversary of the creation of the Office of Prime Minister, we'll speak to historian and biographer Anthony Seldon on who's been the best and the worst. Plus, why is there no Museum of Prime Ministers? All that to come in the next hour. If you subscribe to The Spectator's YouTube channel, why wouldn't you? It's free. You'll never miss a program. Just click the subscribe button at the bottom right of the screen now. And as always, a very special thanks to Charles Stanley for their continued support of the Week in 60 Minutes this year. Charles Stanley is one of the UK's leading wealth management firms, one of the oldest companies on the London Stock Exchange, and we are delighted to have them as our partners. Britain passed a miserable milestone of 100,000 COVID deaths this week. It's a grim statistic, a terrible toll which puts even more pressure on the vaccine rollout, not just to lead us out of lockdown, but to slash fatalities. So far, it's so good, but there is some way to go yet. I'm joined by Kate Andrews, the editor of The Spectator's daily COVID-19 update email. You should get that. It's the only roundup you need for the latest coronavirus news in Britain and abroad. Kate, update us and go through the latest numbers, please.
As you can see here, cases peaked around the start of the year and are now showing a clear trajectory of decline, with cases hovering around where they were, say, December 20th, roughly last year, when Tier 4 had been brought in for millions of people, but other areas of the UK remain slightly more liberalised. As we know with this virus, there is a lag between infection and hospitalisation, and you would expect, if cases were dropping at the start of the month, that we would now start to see a decline in hospitalisation. This is by no means reflecting the decline that you saw in cases in that previous slide, but we have had some positive news from the Health Service Journal this morning, showing that that COVID positive patients in English hospitals fell by nearly 1,500 yesterday, and they're describing that as the biggest daily decline recorded since the start of the pandemic. It reflects another big decline, just over 1,000 on the 17th of April, which was the start of a very steep descent. But the fact is, Andrew, as you say, we've hopefully turned the tide on this wave of the virus, but that's not what's in the main news this week. The stark number of the week is 100,000, and that represents the UK's accumulative death toll, COVID death toll, since last spring. The Prime Minister addressed the nation this week, saying he was deeply sorry that he accepts responsibility in his handling of this crisis, something that will no doubt be looked at in an inquiry down the line. But I think there's little doubt that the government wants certain parts of the crisis focused on more than others. And that is what is embodied in the vaccine race, and I can give you an update on that. Now, I don't want to get too optimistic because we are a year into this crisis. The UK is in its third lockdown, so let's not pretend things can't go wrong. But so far, it is looking like quite a remarkable success story. The UK's decision last year not to join the European Union in procuring vaccines and going in alone instead looks to be one of the best decisions it's made during the crisis, as well as the idea to invest across the board in multiple vaccines, despite at the time people thinking there was a relatively low probability that any of them would work. They secured over 350 million doses, and that's more than four jabs per adult. So that has been a remarkable success for the UK. And what you're looking at here in this graph has prompted some pretty wild behaviour from the European Union this week, which understandably is growing increasingly desperate to get their hands on the vaccine, but less understandably has started to undermine diplomacy and order. This includes warning that it might restrict exports of vaccines made in the bloc, a suggestion of the erosion of contract law, rejecting the notion of first come, first served. Now, the UK is trying to stay out of it. They're saying that this is a dispute between the EU and Big Pharma and the providers, but it is likely to be drawn in further, especially if pressure starts to mount for the UK, once its most vulnerable members of the population are vaccinated, to donate these vaccines to the rest of Europe. But there are other political problems for the UK, other fights to be had. And this is a graph showing the rate of vaccinations within the four nations, and highlights a problem that Boris Johnson has. Not that England isn't doing well, but he's up in Scotland today making the case for the union, an issue that is becoming an increasing pressure point for the Prime Minister. And it's charts like this that the Prime Minister will use to make his case that the union is stronger together, that Westminster really had a handle not just on procuring these vaccines, but also knowing how to administer them. But these are crucial weeks for the Prime Minister. He needs to meet his target of mid-February by having the most four vulnerable groups inoculated. Again, reasons to be hopeful. The current projections and forecasts would suggest that the UK might hit this target a day or two early, which you can see in this graph. But this is not just about turning the tide on the virus. It's very much from a political perspective about turning the tide on how we view this government, its handling of COVID-19, and how efficient it really is. On that note, I'll throw back over to you, Andrew.
Okay, thank you for that. Let me bring in James Forsyth, our political editor, and Katie Bowles, our deputy political editor, to reflect on this week's politics. James, this milestone of 100,000 deaths from COVID, which places amongst per capita amongst the worst in terms of performance, the human toll is obvious and huge. Is the Prime Minister paying a political toll for it as well?
Not in the way I think that many people in Westminster had expected. I still think the public don't view the virus. They view the virus as a kind of natural disaster in the way that they would view flooding or a hurricane, rather than as a kind of straightforward political issue. And so while I think the government does, obviously, you know, you look at how big the government's leads were early in this crisis when the rally round the flag effect was in full force, and where they are now, you know, obviously the mistakes made have taken a toll on the government's poll ratings. But we're still in a situation where Labour are marginally ahead. YouGov today gave them a slightly bigger lead than usual, 4 points. But, you know, we're still in a world where the two parties are, if you kind of average out the polls, neck and neck. And I think the big question, as Kate Andrews said, in terms of the public's view on this, is what happens with the vaccine rollout? Because I think that if at the end of this crisis the UK is coming out of it before other countries, then I think the public will take a more benign view of the government's handling of the whole crisis. But if the vaccine ends up being hit by some of the same problems that PPE procurement was, or track and trace was, then I think the public's view will become much more negative. And so I think essentially the what will determine how the public look back on the government's handling of this crisis is this vaccine rollout.
Katie, is that the politics of it? The mistakes the government made in 2020 were many, some of them very big, and they're pretty well catalogued now. We know what they are, from test and trace to protective equipment and other things, being slow to lock down when it should have done. But is the thought in government that in the end that won't matter so much if they get the vaccine rollout right? In other words, what will stay in people's memories is a successful exit from the pandemic rather than the unsuccessful periods of the pandemic last year.
Yes, I do think now the focus in government is actually you can turn things around by having that positive vaccine story. You see it this week, lots of coverage of the fact we have passed 100,000 deaths, but also lots of coverage of this positive vaccine development. And there's that juxtaposition going. I think there's still difficult points for the government. I think if you look at the figures and how we've reached 100,000, the number of deaths from November is really startling. You know, this wasn't all in the first wave. In fact, I think this idea the government had, which you make mistakes in the beginning, I think you could argue they made mistakes up until very recently. But ultimately, I think the sense in number 10 is if they can keep up the pace currently on vaccinations, if they can be the leading country across Europe, then that's what people are going to remember. And that is what you're going to get to this summer. And I think it's no coincidence that there is lots of talk about postponing the local elections in May. All of a sudden, the government are quite keen to have them. That's because they think they're getting a vaccine boost.
James, when the government announced that it was not going to be part of the EU procurement approach, which it could have been, as I understand it, even though we were no longer in the EU, the London chattering classes went mad, saying how disgraceful this is. This is nationalism run riot and Brexiteer nutters and so on. They're not saying that now, are they?
No, and I think what it is I think it showcases the advantages of being a nimble country, being able to move quickly, not having to move at the slowest pace. The UK basically went for emergency authorization rather than the full authorization that the European Medicines Agency is going through with these vaccines. And the UK is essentially trying to get the vaccine rolled out as fast as it is produced. And I think that has given the UK an advantage. I think the other big advantage the UK has is that it has the population in Europe that is by far the most willing to take the vaccine. So that means that you don't have to go slowly to try and build public confidence in the way that it's happening in some other countries. I don't think it's any coincidence that Denmark is one of the EU countries that has made the most progress, and that has the second most pro-vaccination population in Europe after the UK. I think that public willingness to take the vaccine is a crucial part of the success of the UK vaccine rollout.
Whereas in France, which is a rather surprisingly, quite frighteningly large anti-vax movement, so far less than 2% of the population have had the vaccine. We've seen Brussels sort of beat the drum this week, James, almost implying that they may be looking at stopping Pfizer exports from there to the United Kingdom, kind of implying that Britain should be sending over a chunk of its AstraZeneca supplies to the EU. The European press, very unimpressed with Brussels' record so far. How do you think this is going to work out?
Well, I think the UK government is very keen to stay out of this row. Because I think it fears that there are European politicians looking for any excuse to essentially say, well, we're halting these Pfizer exports to the UK. So the UK is very keen to stay out of it. But one thing I would say is, look at the amount of noise the EU is making in this row. If you are confident that you have a legal remedy to your problem, you tend not to make a public song and dance about it. You just instruct your lawyers. So I think the fact that the EU is making this much of a, you know, talking about the AstraZeneca's societal and moral obligations suggests that it isn't confident of a legal remedy. I mean, the UK's view is that when the Oxford University came to the UK government and said, look, we want you to be happy with the vaccine deal we are negotiating, considering its importance. And the UK government said, look, we want a legally watertight guarantee that the UK will have first access to the doses produced in this country. That actually led to Oxford not partnering with Merck, the pharmaceutical company that they were expected to, and instead, with a bit of government matchmaking, partnering with AstraZeneca. But that is because the UK got more in its contract than just a best efforts clause, best endeavours clause, which is what the CEO of AstraZeneca says the EU has in its contract with AstraZeneca. So I think the UK, I think, is on stronger legal ground here in terms of having first refusal on the supply coming out of the UK. I think that it would be a massive step, for all the reasons that Kate set out in her presentation, if the EU were to go down the route that the German government is advocating and impose full-on export controls on vaccines from the bloc. If you had a situation where Pfizer were unable to fulfil a contract that has been signed and paid for with the UK government because of EU action, that would be quite a massive escalation.
And Katie, we've seen some strange stories going around this. Not just the health commissioner from Greece saying, you know, we don't believe in first come, first serve, but this story in Handelsblatt, which the German financial paper, which is a paper, I know a little bit about this paper. It has an incredible reverence for facts. You know, it facts checks everything and has a kind of almost Germanic thoroughness about how it reports things. And yet it came out with a report that said the AstraZeneca vaccine was only effective for 8% of over 65s, which the German government and AstraZeneca both said is nonsense. And yet it doubled down on the story. What does the British government make of all this?
I think ministers are perplexed. I think there's also a sense of annoyance. I think some are actually seething at what they see as disinformation in terms of what's coming out. Because also, I think there's a sense, you touched on the fact that publication is known for actually wanting to publish facts. I think there is a sense that this isn't coming from nowhere. I think they worry that someone is actually negatively briefing within government against the Oxford vaccine, perhaps for reasons if you look at the whole events of the week. And as you say, the publication doubled down. And I think it adds to this thing, there is a huge row going on at the moment about vaccine wars, about the Oxford vaccine, about the lack of supply. The EU haven't yet approved the Oxford vaccine. They can't actually use it yet. I think there are several million doses ready to go when they do approve it. But I think we're looking ahead now to Friday, when we're expecting it could be approved. And while I think the 8% efficacy line has been widely rebuffed, you've had the German government come out against it, I think that where these publications are still saying there could be something is it going to be approved for the elderly? Is there going to be an age limit in the EU approval? And I think the only way we're going to find out the truth in terms of the smoke and mirrors at the moment is a journalist having an incredibly bad week, or is there something more to it, is when they announce their decision on approval.
Well, Vaccine Wars is the cover story of The Spectator this week. It's got a great cover, and it's a two-page spread on what's going on by Matthew Lynn. It's well worth a read. James and Katie, stay with us. There's more politics to talk about. But let me, for the moment, welcome Professor David Salisbury. He's an immunization expert. He's held roles at the WHO and the Department of Health, among other places. Professor, welcome to Spectator TV. Can I just come right in on one factual question? It is right, in your view, that AstraZeneca's vaccine only works for 8%. That's not right, is it, Professor?
I can't find that figure anywhere. I just don't know where they got that from, what it relates to.
Let me stand back a little bit, Professor, because not much less than a year ago, the view from experts seemed to be that it could take 10 years to get a vaccine. It could be done less than that, but it was going to be a long while. And I suppose sometimes in the day-to-day news that we get, we don't quite realize the amazing thing that's happened, because here we are less than a year into this pandemic, and I think we've now got three vaccines that are operating, and China and Russia of theirs too. It is a remarkable scientific achievement, is it not?
No, it's fantastic, and nobody should ever take that away from what has been achieved. To have got from nothing to vaccines already being implemented in this period of time is an extraordinary achievement. And it's not just an extraordinary achievement for now for coronavirus. I think that the whole future of the way in which we make vaccines is going to change. And the RNA vaccines that are synthetic, you basically take the gene and you make the vaccine based on the gene, and away you go, transformative.
And we've become familiar with the Pfizer vaccine because it was the first on the block, and then, of course, the Oxford AstraZeneca one, and there's a third one that was approved, I think, first in America. We now hear that this Johnson & Johnson vaccine coming along, which apparently, please correct me if I'm wrong here, you only need one jab. You don't need a follow-up jab. That could be a huge game changer, Professor. What's your view on that?
I think we need to wait and see quite what comes out from the data for J&J and what it gets licensed for. And there have been studies on two doses on that vaccine as well. I think we need to just be a bit cautious about thinking that we will have one dose. And if we do have one dose vaccines and they are effective and the immunity lasts, again, great advance. really welcome. But let's just hold back on that, because so far many of the other vaccines are clearly two dose.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting why that one is different. We in the United Kingdom, we vaccinated as of this morning about 7.5 million, but only under 500,000 have had their second dose. Are you comfortable with the emphasis on getting the first jab done, even at the expense of a second jab being delayed? Medically, is that something that you're comfortable with?
Yeah, I've been a strong proponent of this from even before it was ever announced. It seemed to me that it's a sort of no-brainer. And the numbers are so obvious. If you have 1 million people and you give them two doses at 95% efficacy, you protect 950,000 of them. Now take 2 million people, give them one dose. Even if the efficacy was low as 60%, I mean, it's not, but even if it were, that's 1.2 million protected. It's just so straightforward. If we want to save lives, give first doses to as many people as we can, then you catch up with the second doses.
And is there a time limit for the second dose to be effective?
Well, we don't know that. What we do know is from general principles about vaccines, actually, the longer interval you have between the doses, the better the immune response. Really? The shorter the interval, the more you push getting a good immune response. So there's a lot in favour of these delayed second doses.
Fascinating. Now, how comfortable are you, or how worried are you, I should say, with the fear I've seen expressed that will the vaccines that we have, will it handle these variants, these mutations? We see the Kent variant, South African variant, and so on. Is that a cause for concern?
I think it is. And I think we have to be very careful about the assumptions for the long term, because we know that the vaccine is effective so far against the UK variant. We've got enough people saying we've tested this. We've got concerns about South Africa and Brazil. One of the other things that I think we've learnt is that you can change these vaccines quickly because of the way in which they're made. And I think that we have to look at the model that we've long been comfortable with, which is flu vaccination, where pretty much every year we have a new flu vaccine. And we've learned how to do that, and we've learned how to anticipate that. So I can see the future being a coronavirus vaccine, just like our flu vaccine every autumn. The problem I see in the short term about this is if we got variants that the vaccine didn't work against, what do we do with all the people that we've just vaccinated? And I think we've got to just plan ahead for something like that. But maybe that's me being very worried.
No, it's clearly it's something that we can't forget, that it's not a straight line to getting out of this pandemic, that there are potholes and rocks in the road, and we need to be aware of that. And I thank you for making that point, Professor. How do you assess the robustness of our supply chains as we ramp up the vaccines? Are we going to get to the government's targets, do you think?
Well, if you extrapolate from where we are to where they want to be in mid-February, I think it's looking good. Vaccine campaigns are about three things, and they all have to come together in the same place at the same time. Supply, people to do the vaccinating, people to be vaccinated. The second and third, I think, are looking really good. And the first depends entirely on what the manufacturers can give us and whether perhaps we may be restrained on what it is that we're going to get. Although I think there's a bit of hot air currently being blown in our direction.
What do you mean by that?
Well, if you have a contract in place for a certain amount of vaccine, if somebody says, well, by the way, you can't have that because we're going to have it, actually, the supplier is then in breach of contract. So, whilst the EU is talking about AZ, for instance, being in breach of contract with them, if they were to find a way of having our contracted vaccine diverted, then AZ would be in breach of contract with the UK. So they are stuck in the middle. And there are other issues that they just aren't, the EU, that is, aren't talking about. And one of the, firstly, if the vaccine that they want is being produced in the UK, has that production been licensed for Europe? And that's a really big question. Have they looked at all of the manufacturing? And even silly things like the packages and the leaflets that go in the packages for UK production are in English.
Yes.
You know, just to say we want some of your vaccine is an awfully long way from getting it legally.
Yes, I saw somewhere that one of the things that's holding things up in Europe was the need or the demand to have the instructions in 24 or 25 different languages, which has held things up. How much, Professor, of the population has to be vaccinated for the pandemic really to recede as a threat?
Oh, that's tough. There are two sections to this. Firstly, how many people have you got to protect them? In other words, the high risk group. And the answer is as many of you as you possibly can, if not all. How many of those people who are not in the high risk group do you have to vaccinate to stop transmission so that they don't spread it? And if you took an estimate of roughly 65% of the population immune, well, you've got to vaccinate more than 65% of them to get there. So we've got quite a way to go. We're doing fantastically well protecting the vulnerable. I think it's going to be a much harder call when we try to vaccinate the younger people for whom the benefit is much less. And so they don't necessarily see themselves at the same risk, and they may not come forward in the same numbers. And if we don't get them, we don't stop transmission, and we will still be living with this virus for a while.
And from being vaccinated to being more immune to the vaccine, how long is the period? Because it's not right away, is it?
No, I mean, if you again look at the sort of the data from the trials, and it's between 2 and 3 weeks after your first dose. And, you know, for safety's sake, people are talking about wait, you know, 3 weeks, you will have lots of antibodies and you should be well protected. And we then need to make sure that later on we get our second doses to fulfill that protection.
Professor, just a final question. In these dark times with the lockdown still pretty severe in the UK and elsewhere, we passed that terrible milestone of 100,000 deaths from COVID. Is it possible to raise our spirits and look to a time, perhaps before this year is out, when there will be a surplus of vaccines? And we can actually start sending vaccines to places that at the moment don't have them or can't afford them.
I think that's absolutely right, and I hope that's the way of the future. If you look at the UK, you look at the US, you look at Canada, we've all got on contract far more vaccine than we could ever need. And I think that what people should do is, as we get to a degree of comfort about our own programmes, offer vaccine out of our contracts so that we don't draw them down. Recycling vaccines is much more difficult. If you've already got them in stock, it's much harder to send them on to someone else. But if you've got contracts that you have not drawn down, for goodness sake, offer those vaccines to other people that want to take them.
Indeed. Professor, that's a good point for us to end on. Professor Salisbury, thank you for joining us on Spectator TV today. Let me go back to James Forsyth and Katie Bowles, and go to you, Katie, because you, in the magazine this week, you've published your interview with the Children's Commissioner, Anne Longfield. She's just stepping down after a number of years in the job. And in a way, it's quite a depressing interview because of the emphasis that she puts on this huge mental health issues that have developed from among children during lockdown, and many more suffering from it. And it's not a problem that can be overcome very quickly. Tell us more about what she told you.
Yes, you're right. It makes for uncomfortable reading, because while as Children's Commissioner, she's keen to get children back in the classroom as soon as possible, which could be early March now. We know it's not after the February half term immediately. Her point is, even if you do that, there's this huge overhang. There are so many problems created from the past year of children being out of the classroom, of the pandemic. There's going to take a real, concentrated effort from the government, a catch-up programme, which isn't just about education, which is clearly an issue in terms of the inequality between the advantage and the disadvantage exacerbated by the pandemic, but also just the effect on children's mental health. We've seen a rise in the number of children identifying with a mental health disorder, also a rise in eating disorders specifically. And I think we're just entering uncharted territory in the sense that no one is quite sure how long, how hard this is going to be to reverse. And she said to me that she thinks, for all this talk of a 2-year programme that might be needed, she thinks this could actually be up to 3 to 5 years of efforts going to be needed to try and remedy some of the harms.
She thought there was a need for a nationwide mobilisation to repair the damage. She told you in the interview that has been done to our children. She called it a Nightingale moment, that we needed to, as what we had done with building the Nightingale hospitals, we needed that kind of concentrated effort to deal with the mental health issues that are developing among children, as you say, had to go on for a long time. I can see the sense of all that. I also just wonder whether the demands on government as we come out of the pandemic, as we hope we will, the demands on government are going to be huge. I just wonder how it could ever cope with all this that it has to do.
Exactly. I mean, there's a bandwidth issue as it is. And I think the frustration that she has is that when she points to the Nightingale furlough, she believes when there is political will, things do happen. And I think that it's essentially also here, I think, from the chair of the Education Select Committee, Rob Halfen, in Parliament, which is there is just this concern that education is not seen as one of the absolute top priorities. Yes, everyone's keen to say it's really important. But if you look at actions, they think it's become a second tier issue. I think in terms of mental health and how the government are going to be able to respond to that, I think, again, she's talking about how there could be some hope in the fact that if you're talking about children and mental health, they're actually much more adaptable to online, and there could be a way of using online resources to do quite a bit here. But ultimately, what these children have been missing is actually being in a room with other children, adults, human contact, and that's something that no amount of online tuition or support can make up for.
No, indeed. James, the Prime Minister has been coming under some pressure to open the schools more quickly, or at least to give some guidance, some kind of timetable as to when we can expect it. Any chance the primary schools could open after what would have been the February midterm break, but perhaps the secondary schools will have to wait till closer to Easter?
Judging from what the Prime Minister said yesterday, Andrew, I think the earliest we can expect schools to go back is the 8th of March. And I think the big question is whether...
Even primary schools, James.
Even primary schools. The big question is whether it's a kind of big bang reopening with kind of all year groups going back at the in the same week, or whether it is, as you say, more staggered, with primary school children who are less likely to spread the virus going back first, and then secondary school children at a later date. I think the big question here is, and I think one of the challenges for the government, is how to prevent the country from having long COVID in terms of educational inequalities and all of these issues. Because this is going to take years to wash out of the education system. All we know about the importance of early years education and the like, the idea that you can take children out of school for the amount of time they've been out of school without this having a lasting effect, I think is full of buzz. I think it was very striking in Katie's interview how Children's Commissioner is talking about a much longer term programme of catch-up work than Westminster is currently thinking about. I think the government is going to have to accept that this is going to have to be a permanent shift. And one thing I do wonder about is whether those long summer holidays, which we've always known are bad for educational equality, because in crude terms, middle-class kids do better in those holidays than working-class kids. Yes. Whether as a society, is one of the things we're going to have to think about getting rid of those summer holidays. Is that going to be one of the things we're going to have to do to try and level the playing field going forward?
James, where are we now on border controls? It's been a long time coming. There's been a lot of talk. Are we clear now what the government has in store?
Well, I think this is one area where the government is essentially admitting that it got things wrong earlier in the crisis. You know, it famously didn't shut the borders. You know, flights came back from Wuhan and other parts of China. Now the government is saying anyone flying in from a red list country, essentially a country which has a new variant in it, or it has close links, like Portugal has close links to Brazil, to a country with a new variant in it, will have to quarantine in a hotel for 10 days. This will be much, much stricter than a previous quarantine policy, where you could just go to your own house and, you know, the government might call you up occasionally and ask if you were there, but no more than that. This will be, you know, supervised quarantine in a hotel. We know that the Home Secretary, Priti Patel, would have liked to go further and have done this for people coming in from all countries. But in the end, the decision was made to limit it to people from these at-risk countries. I think this is a sign of the ways in which, even if we get back to domestic normality this summer, we're unlikely to get back to the kind of classic British summer with huge numbers of people jetting off on flights to Europe for a bit of sun.
If you turn up, though, at a British airport and you have a test that says you tested negative within the last 72 hours, what's the reason the government is saying that you need to quarantine?
I mean, the theory is that if you come from these at-risk countries, the risk is so great that you were negative 72 hours ago, but you might not be negative right now. Or you might be incubating the disease, the virus, that they feel that they want to put you into quarantine for that time. I mean, their great fear at the moment is that you could get a vaccine-evading variant, which essentially would require the vaccines to be tweaked, which they think can be done relatively quickly, but then would require another mass vaccination programme, which would obviously be a body blow to the economy.
And there must be some suspicion, I would have thought, that if you begin with the red list of the countries, the Brazils and so on, that have, particularly those that seem to have a variant, South Africa, I think another one, that could be extended, that it could go much further than that list.
Yes, although the kind of the argument in government for the current position is that you are most likely to see the variant where the virus is in kind of rapid circulation. So if you can take those countries out of the equation, you know, countries with very, very low levels of COVID are unlikely to produce a variant. And so that is the confidence. But I think this is the interesting question, which is, you know, how, you know, we talk about normality. I mean, there is a pretty good chance that you have something approaching normality domestically this summer. But the more complicated question to ask is when do we get back to the situation when you can look at a holiday brochure and not think, oh, we've got to check the red list to see whether this country's on the list or not? And I mean, this also comes back to the question that David Salisbury was talking about, which is, you know, how do you ensure that you manage to vaccinate the entire global population? That is a huge logistical challenge, because however much, you know, the EU and the UK are tussling over who gets vaccines, the rich world at the moment has vastly more vaccine than the developing world. How do you manage to ensure that? Because unless you have managed to vaccinate essentially the global population, there is a risk that this virus could come back.
Well, it sounds like normality when it comes to holidays. James is going to be more Bognor than Biarritz in 2020.
See you in Blackpool.
What's wrong with Bognor, though? I remember what a king...
I won't say the famous late king's words.
I won't repeat the king's words of what he said about Bognor. Let's finish up this segment with Katie. The Tory backbenchers, will they wear these border controls? Is that something they've been wanting, or does it fire up the lockdown skeptics?
I think it sits fine in the short term. I think that if you speak to lockdown skeptics, actually they think while we're in a lockdown here, it makes sense to have tighter border controls. I think where the crunch will come is ultimately these MPs also think people should be able to go on summer holidays. So let's see how this lasts in the medium to long term, because you're also going to hear pressure again to help out the aviation industry. So short term measure, yes. Some people think it should have been done quicker. Long term, I think you're going to start to see a row.
James and Katie, thank you for that. But before I let you go, James, we understand that while we've been recording this, there's been some news out of Germany that they will only approve AstraZeneca's vaccine for the under 65s, which kind of plays to the Handelsblatt story we were talking about that it wasn't effective for the over 65s. This is a remarkable development. Tell us what's happening.
Yes, this touches on what Katie was saying earlier about, you know, what is, you know, this story appeared in Handelsblatt, a similar story appeared in Bild, probably didn't appear out of thin air. And I think we see here that the Robert Koch Institute in Germany, who are in charge of the vaccination campaign there, the Financial Times and the Times are both reporting that it will recommend that AstraZeneca is only used on under 65s on the grounds that there is insufficient data on its efficacy on the over 65s to approve its use. I think it's important to stress this isn't a safety concern. This is an efficacy concern. Now, I suspect that we will see the efficacy of the Oxford vaccine on the over 65s quite quickly in the UK's numbers. Either the UK's hospitalizations and deaths among the over 80s, where the vast majority have now been vaccinated, will start to drop very rapidly, or they won't. So I think actually this question of the efficacy of the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine on the over 65s will be settled quite quickly by real world data from the UK. But I think this is only going to add to the tensions about the AstraZeneca jab and the EU. And I think also this rebuke of the AstraZeneca jab, I hardly see that is going to help relations between the EU and the company, considering how hardball the EU are playing about how AstraZeneca must get them more doses.
All right. Well, James, thank you for that. It is a bizarre development. We'll learn more of it as the day goes on. But I guess if the Germans don't want it for the over 65s, then they won't need as much of it. And Britain can continue to supply its own over 65s with the AZ vaccine. Anyway, what would a quarantine system for travellers coming into the country look like? Let's hear from someone who's lived behind closed borders since March of last year, almost a year. In this week's Spectator, Terry Barnes writes about the Australian experience. Now, Terry's a regular contributor to the hugely successful Australian edition of The Spectator. He's a former policy advisor to Tony Abbott, former Australian Prime Minister, when Tony Abbott was Health Minister. Terry, thanks for joining us from Melbourne. Just tell us how this has worked in Australia.
Well, I mean, in terms of the numbers that we're talking about and I'm hearing you talk about, I mean, we're dealing with roughly 30,000 COVID infections since March. We've had just over 900 COVID-related deaths, including 800 in one second wave episode in Victoria. And we've, I think at the moment we've only got about 125 people hospitalised with COVID. So the reality is that, it's absolutely hard for Australians to understand how Britain has passed that 100,000 figure, because with one third of the population, we have less than 1/100th of the COVID mortality that Britain does. And that's largely because of actions that were taken by not only the federal government, but our state and territory governments working with them back in March to, one, seal the borders, effectively cauterise them. Because one of the advantages of being Australia, of course, is that we're a great big island with no land borders. And the other thing is that we got going very early on the idea of hotel quarantine, effectively sealing off or sequestering travellers when they arrive in Australia. So not only are almost no people coming to the country at the moment, I think the allowance at the moment is 3,000 in a week. The hotel quarantine regime means that when it's working well, means that most of the COVID infections we're seeing at the moment, and there is a few, but not very many, and most of those, almost all of them now, I think, as of today, are in a hotel quarantine.
Terry, these are remarkable figures. I want to come on to the quarantine issue in a minute, but just to go back to what you're saying and to put this in perspective for our viewers. So Australia's population is about 25 million. The United Kingdom's population is under 70 million, probably around about 68. So we're not yet three times the people of Australia. We've had over 100,000 deaths. Australia's had fewer than 1,000 deaths. And at the moment, there are only 125 active cases of COVID in the country. I mean, from a British view, that is a remarkable story of success.
Indeed it is. And Australians are, on the whole, we may be find it hard from time to time to knuckle down to what governments are requiring us to do to prevent the spread of infection. And certainly here in Melbourne, we were under a very, very tight lockdown, really from July until November.
That was from the Victoria government.
That was from the second wave in Melbourne, yes, which actually happened because the first hotel quarantine program in Melbourne was very badly cobbled together very quickly, very badly run. You had untrained amateurs, pub bouncers, security guards actually running or doing the guarding, but also getting friendly with the people who they were looking after. So community transmission within the hotel became community transmission right across Melbourne, and it really showed that to make it a success, hotel quarantine programs have to be very well managed. They have to be supervised. Social distancing has to be maintained, which means that it's no five-star Club Med resort. I mean, it's not even a Butlins holiday camp. I mean, basically, you're stuck in a room for a fortnight. You have no maid service. You have no room service. Your food is brought to you and left outside the door. You basically make your own bed, and clean your own room, but you're effectively confined to quarters with a very limited chance to exercise. So it is, as some people have described it, it is basically prison with Wi-Fi.
And just to clarify, the first wave of attempting this actually resulted in a spreading of the pandemic because it wasn't being done professionally enough. The security wasn't professional. I think you mentioned in your article, you said again, sort of nightclub bouncers were brought in to kind of keep people there. Now the military has been involved, the police are involved, the medical system's involved, and that has made it much more of a success. Is that right?
I think that's right. I mean, lessons were learned from what happened in Melbourne and what happened with certainly early troubles in other states as well. And now I think programs around the country, and each state capital city has their own hotel quarantine regime, effectively have contained the virus. In terms of community transmission in the big states, New South Wales, Victoria and Queensland, in Victoria, my state, we haven't had a new community case in about 3 weeks. New South Wales basically has got a clean bill of health only the last couple of days, and internal borders in Australia, and that's been another issue with hotel quarantine and quarantine generally, is that states have been closing their borders to other states, which has effectively pitted Australian against Australian. I think that's been the worst aspect of the whole COVID experience for us. But as far as the international side goes, I think people have accepted it. Even people who are on the certainly on the more liberal or the personal freedom side of the agenda, they've really accepted that, one, you've got to do these things for the common good, and two, if you are travelling, you are returning home, or you're coming from overseas as a foreigner, this is the price you pay for re-entering or entering Australia.
Do you think it could work in Britain? You say in your article in The Spectator this week, Australia's an island continent. It's a long way away from other places. You really have to fly there. Most people have to do that. The populations are different. It's not a global hub in the way that Britain, London in particular, is a global hub. Plus, you've done it from the start. We're only talking about it now, almost a year in. Is it something, other lessons for Britain?
Well, I think it's reported that Priti Patel wanted to shut the borders really from the start back in March. And I think if you'd done that, you wouldn't have a fraction of the problem that you have at the moment over there. But the other side of it is that you have to get a balance right between keeping the country open, keeping the economy going, keeping people in jobs. The thing that really gobsmacks me about what the government has announced in Britain with this 22-country hot list is I can't see how it's going to work successfully, because the thing about what we have done is that we went all the way. We've shut down borders as totally as we could. We basically ensured that people, wherever they came from, went into quarantine to be selective. For 22 countries who are on the list, okay, but there are 200-odd countries around the world, and most of them have people who want to go to Britain or want to pass through Britain. And viruses don't actually recognise foreign borders. They don't recognise frontiers. They go where they go. There's no, I think, certain guarantee that what has been announced is going to actually be the magic bullet in the way that it's being talked about.
I can see that. Final question, Terry, just on the Australian experience. There are very few flights, as I understand it now, to Australia. And what flights there are very expensive. If you arrive there and go into quarantine, you have to pay for that. It's about £1,700 for an individual, and a bit less if there are then more people involved. It's a lot of money. The consequence of that has been that there are 40,000 Australian citizens who are stranded abroad, if I can put it that way. Is the government under no pressure to do something to bring them home?
The government's under quite a lot of pressure on that, Andrew. As I said before, the current limit on new arrivals to Australia in a week is 3,000. That's half a dozen jumbo jets. Not enough to get a fraction of Australians who are stranded abroad home. Yes, I think the government is under pressure. They've certainly increased the number of flights that they have chartered that they are paying for to bring people home. But it's still going to take some time. Again, I think there's been some broad resignation on the part of those who are stranded from what I'm hearing. But also, I think in terms of the Australian community, they see it as a price we've had to pay in order to keep Australia as COVID-free as we possibly can make it.
All right, Terry, we'll leave it there. Terry Barnes of Spectator Australia, thank you very much for joining us on Spectator TV from Melbourne. Now, remember, if you subscribe to The Spectator's YouTube channel for free, you'll never miss another episode. Just click the subscribe button at the bottom right of the screen now. Finally, this year, the Office of Prime Minister, of British Prime Minister, marks its 300th anniversary. Yeah, 1721, Walpole. Should there be a museum dedicated to Downing Street and its occupants to mark the occasion? Historian and biographer of numerous prime ministers, Anthony Seldon, he argues in this week's edition of The Spectator that there should be, and he joins us now. Anthony, welcome to Spectator TV. Why do you think, you bring up the point that every president now in the America has their own library and a bespoke building and scholars can go and study all the papers and so on. Why have we never done anything like that for British prime ministers?
Well, Andrew, the Prime Minister, of course, is not head of state, unlike the 45 US presidents. So there's an extra dimension there. But effectively, the Prime Minister has taken over many of the responsibilities of the head of state. So when Robert Walpole, back in April 1721, was invited to be First Lord of the Treasury and Chancellor of the Exchequer, the office was combined at the time, he was in awe of George I, George II from 1727, and they were powerful people. So I think it's something about the fact that, America, there's more money, but there's also head of state. And I think we need to have more reverence and recognition of the importance of this office on this anniversary. If it's not done now, Andrew, when will it be done?
I thought that your article in this week's Spectator, I thought, was fascinating because you reminded us of the incredibly important decisions, not just for Britain, but for the whole world, that were taken in that cabinet room in 10 Downing Street with prime ministers chairing them. Decisions that in the end lost us the 13 colonies and led to the Declaration of Independence. Decisions to go to war against Germany in 1914, 1939. Huge global decisions. And yet we have no museum that deals with this. It is a remarkable gap, is it not?
It is. I mean, it is the most famous address in the world. The US was governed from Downing Street for its first 55 years until the Declaration of Independence. And so it's very important to the Americans, but it's important to India, it's important to China. It's that this, from this office, and not least in the 19th century, when Britain was arguably the most important power in the globe, the decisions were pumped out of that office. And so it's not just a British asset, it's a global treasure. And what's so funny is that, you know, it's still being used as an office, and people who work in there are really pretty unaware of the history of it, which is exactly why I thought this would be a good idea.
Well, I've been in Downing Street quite a few times, but it was your article that brought home to me the history of it that I hadn't really thought enough about. If we had a museum of prime ministers or whatever we call it, Anthony, what would be in it? How do you envisage this museum?
Well, I think we have to ask who would it be for? And we have to accept the fact that, unlike the White House, where and many other offices of heads of state and heads of government across the world, where visitors can come in, so there is a public education role in that. You can't do it in Downing Street because it's too small, too awkward. I mean, it's wildly improbable that this terraced house in a pretty unprepossessing street has become this great office. It wasn't purpose-built like the Elysee, like the Viceroy's Palace.
And the White House.
You said
in your article that it, for some prime ministers before Disraeli, it wasn't grand enough, so they didn't live there.
It was. I mean, can you imagine Wellington? You know, if he's got his house on Hyde Park Corner.
On One Hyde Park.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, I mean, why would you want to go and live in this very smelly, dirty, sinking, grubby house? So some of them did. I mean, Pitt did, and Peel did, and Walpole did. But a lot of the grandees who tended to be prime ministers. So I think what you'd do is you would have a replica of the most important rooms in that building, and not just... I think it's also important that it's regionally spread also, so that, you know, there is one up in Edinburgh, there is one in Cardiff and in Belfast too. So there's a sense of it being the office of the whole of the United Kingdom rather than the Prime Minister for the southeast of England, which is often, not least by dint of the derivation of the Prime Ministers, what it seemed to be.
So... let's finish on this, and you know, let's hope your idea takes off. If a spectator could help on that, we'd be delighted to do so.
Thank you.
Help and raise some money and so on. But so 300 years of British prime ministers, going back to Walpole in 1721. Let me ask you about the best or the worst in two sections. Let's take since 1945, modern times, if we can call it that. Over the past 70-odd years. Who have been the best prime ministers?
Two contenders, Andrew, both wildly different. The second one largely undid the work of the first. And they're Clement Attlee from 1945 to 51, the Labour prime minister, who achieved what Lloyd George didn't after the First World War in 1918, of building a land fit for heroes, introducing the social and economic policies that set the tone for the next 30 years and positioned Britain's place in the world, in the UN, found a member of NATO, atomic power, third atomic power in the world, and independence for India, and much more. So really a defining administration. The second one, obviously, Margaret Thatcher from 1979 to 1990, not just because she was the first woman. She won three general elections, first time since Liverpool at the beginning of the 19th century, but she remoulded the whole shape of Britain, and unpicking much of what Attlee had done. So, I mean, and on the world stage, a giant figure, the most significant prime minister globally since 1945 by a distance. So they're the two giants.
I agree with that. I think that Attlee and Thatcher are the two most significant prime minister since 1945 because of exactly for the reasons you gave. Okay, let me go to before 39. Now, you've noticed I've missed out 40 to 45. With your agreement, I hope I'm parking Churchill as being sui generis. In Roy Jenkins' biography of him, despite being the huge admirer of Gladstone, he says he was the greatest prime minister. Let me park Churchill. Before 1939, who would you mark out as our greatest prime ministers?
Well, I think Walpole, because he created the office, still the longest serving prime minister, Andrew, 21 years, and he so nearly got flipped out at different points. It was pretty tenuous, often his survival, not least when George I, his great patron, died. Then you go to Pitt, the younger, who really consolidated the office without Pitt being there for most of the time between 1783 and 1806, during the revolutionary and Napoleonic wars, holding the country together.
And he took on foreign policy, as I understand it, which previously had really been the palace ran foreign policy.
Absolutely. I mean, wresting it out of the control of George III, who was a much more activist king than his George I and II. But, you know, he'd got his fingers so badly burnt on foreign policy with the American Civil War and the loss of the 13 colonies that he lost his confidence. And Pitt was supremely confident in directing that war, but consolidating the post. And then I think very briefly, you have to go to Gladstone because he shaped the premiership for the era of mass political parties and the beginning of the mass franchise, beginning programmatic politics, the idea that you put a programme to the public in a general election. And I think you have to finish off then with Lloyd George, absolute scoundrel, arguably the biggest scoundrel, though there are lots of contenders since Walpole, perhaps ever, but he did see the country successfully through the last 2 years of the First World War, and dynamic at the Treaty of Versailles, getting Britain's position bang in there in the post-war settlement and solving the Irish question. You know, the question, Andrew, is why are there so few great prime ministers compared to, say, German chancellors since 1945 or indeed US presidents? Many of them have disappointed.
Indeed. There's good choices there, I think, Anthony. You've got a book coming out on British prime ministers, haven't you?
In beginning of April with Cambridge, where I try to bring together, I wrote it during COVID, but really for 40 years I've been writing about prime ministers. So it was nice to be able to pull all that together and think, you know, why has the office survived? Is it still the same office? Who are, exactly your question, you know, who are the great ones and why are there not more? But also how can we improve the office for the fourth decade, for the fourth century?
And the title of your book?
Impossible Office with a question mark.
Impossible.
You know, has it just become impossible to succeed?
Anthony Selden, thank you for your time today on Spectator TV. It's great to talk to you.
Thank you for having me.
That's it for this week. Thanks to all of our guests. And once again, of course, to our very special sponsor, Charles Stanley. They continue to sponsor The Week in 60 Minutes. Charles Stanley is one of the UK's leading wealth management firms, one of the oldest firms on the London Stock Exchange. We are delighted to have them as our partners. A final reminder, subscribe to The Spectator's YouTube channel. It's free. You'll never miss another episode. Just click the subscribe button at the bottom right of the screen now. As always, send us your thoughts on Spectator TV to spectatortv@spectator.co.uk. And join us again next week. Until then, bye-bye.